Look at the babies. Look at the
Odin has like this kind of lip liner too. Like his
He
lips are.
does.
Hi,
Look at the.
y'all.
Hi,
We're
everybody.
being overwhelmed with animals.
Our animals want to join the party.
As per.
Welcome to Theology on the Rocks, where we are mostly distracted by animals.
Where animals exist. All of our faithful listeners will be like, what do you even mean? You don't
What?
spend more time talking about them than theology.
There wasn't a
Ooh.
whole episode that started with a lot of talk about
We
poop.
did.
We
You know, we
did.
went there. We
We
did.
went there. Yeah.
And I feel
Speaking of,
like
how is Odin's poop?
I know.
Right.
I have a foster kitty
He's
who you will
very.
hear in the background.
Look, for those of
What?
you in North Carolina, just go ahead and adopt that sweet little baby
Yeah, this one's a cute.
because he's so cute.
They're not all created equal, and like I always try to like, pimp them out because I don't need 85 cats. This is now my fourth foster of a cat. I don't have any of the previous three. Two of them live on the lake, and then one lives with my friend Sharon. This one is probably the best out of the three.
He's so stupid.
He would be really good for someone who wants like the vision of a cat that you have in your head, which
Yes.
is like he doesn't want to do much. He's like the Penny. I said the Penny of cats. Like he
He
just
is
wants to sit on your lap,
Yeah.
and like
He's a Velcro cat.
he's a Velcro cat.
Yeah.
Which not cats aren't not a lot of
That's
cats are like
that's
that.
not like what they're famous for, but he is. And he's
No,
got the cutest little eyes, like, 'cause they're
he was
big.
cute.
I said little, but they're big. They're like big.
They're
Yeah.
but yeah. He's a super, super cute cat,
Yeah.
and we'll see how that goes.
We're always waiting to see who the first foster fail is gonna be.
Oh, well, I've been technically foster failed Beethoven, but that's mostly because my friend Sean just wouldn't come get him.
Beethoven was ever a foster. Like, you were just like, we have this cat now. I
Well,
don't.
it was under the pretense of foster.
Maybe at the very start, but you bought him a stocking almost immediately.
Well, he's such a psycho. I like didn't think anyone would take him. So I was just like, you live here now because because he'd already been at my other friend's and it didn't work out because he is a domestic terrorist, which feels almost like I shouldn't say that right now, but he's a very crazy cat.
He is a
And
Penny.
now he's a good ambassador, but he was crazy. So he kind of floated around for a little while and then he just never left my house. And so now he lives here because that's how cats work. So technically I guess none of them are foster fails. Like they were all pretty purposeful. So if this will be the first one if it's a foster fail. But we're gonna give it a go because we want to
You do
share the
have to.
love.
And I like to come to your house. And it's becoming increasingly difficult.
Christy is deathly allergic to cats. Although I try to run a pretty tight ship when it comes to like
It. Also, and this is weird. This is not typically like how people are allergic to cats, but mine is mostly a contact allergy. And so
Oh.
I break out in hives where they touch me.
Good.
So your cats don't like me, and therefore it's not a huge problem.
Well, also they have their own room because we're double income, no kids. We're
Yeah,
dinks.
you're dinks.
So whenever Christy comes over, they go to their room.
They go to the cat room.
They're the cat room. Now, if Christy went in that room, she might immediately
I would
die.
explode.
But generally speaking, they kind of stay away.
Yeah.
Anyway, guys, welcome to Theology on the Rocks, where please come take this cat from me. His name is Odin. It was Opal because we thought it was a girl.
Not.
And come to find out, it had parcels in the back. So,
And
not.
you got
And
them
so,
taken care of. So,
yep, RIP.
Bye bye
So
to the.
we vaccinate and we give this, we neuter our animals, but not the humans anymore, apparently.
Jesus. No,
But that's for next week.
that's for
So,
next year.
guys, we're drinking today a goodbye to the summer. We're drinking Truly's. Because I was with Christy over the weekend, and I left her $45 million Trulies.
I have a plethora. I have so many Truly Unruly's, and I also have so much Coors Light, which is a bane of my existence, but it got me. Coors. It got sour real quick. All of a sudden, it hit me in the back right there.
I'm drinking Truly Red, White, and True, which is those little, you know, it's the flavor of the, they call them bottle pops in the UK, but they're like the, sometimes the UK, I forget US the words. Pops? The rocket pops,
Yeah. Hi, so like so here's the thing. Leah purchased these. They're Truly Unruly lemonades, which I like lemonades. The problem, there's two problems. One is that they're disgusting.
Yeah, no, I think that's the main problem. I think that might be the only problem.
No, there is a second problem here. And the second problem is that carbonated beverages make me really burpy. And so I tend to drink, there are non-carbonated lemonade seltzers that I really enjoy. But these are not non-carbonated. These have bubbles.
But at the end of the day, they are gross.
Anyway, so I'm drinking.
So if you guys thought for a moment that Truly did sponsor our podcast.
It doesn't.
It does not.
Nope. Or would we take? I mean, we would take that. We would change our tune so quickly if somebody wanted to.
I'd be like, welcome. Welcome to Theology on the Rocks. So we're drinking the only favorite, seltzer of the.
My favorite drink. No, so this one is called Bumpin' Blue Raz.
I'm already against it, and I bought these. I'm the one who bought them.
I'm
So I went to see Christy in St. Peter's, well, Seminole, I guess, more than St. Peter's.
Yeah, next.
So we went to go, and then she and Stuart went to go see MCR, and I stayed home and screamed internally about a game that Georgia was playing against Tennessee, and I had no one to yell about that to.
That's true.
And I was taking care of Penny, and she doesn't do well with screaming.
She doesn't love the football season, and it was nice that you guys hit. She loves you too. She was very happy, and then she was very sad when y'all left.
I think Penny's gotten used to us, and I think we're a good vibe for Penny. Like,
yeah.
Chill Stuart people. Is like basically so chill, he's horizontal essentially.
Which she finally clued into because she was like attached to him for a while. She was like, this is my new favorite person. So,
yeah. And I operate when I'm with Stuart and Christy, they're like my Xanax, I think, because I really go pretty low in terms of the psychosis. when they're both together. So that's why this throuple works, because it works well. Y'all chill me out. Also, we drink a lot of wine.
And we made Stuart set up my, we solved the stereo problem, but it came on.
You're saying we really, really loosely right now.
I'm saying we loosely. It came on the Saturday that they were here. And so it arrived, and I brought the box into the house, and I Leah was still asleep, and I just looked at Stuart and I went, hey. And then I started like pulling stuff out, and I was like, so like, I don't really understand what I'm supposed to. And he was like, well, we need to go to the store.
Yeah.
He told me what to buy, and then we came back, and I stood there and said, do you need me to do anything? And he kept being like, no. He like set things up.
When he gets that look in his eye, you just let him go.
Yeah.
Just and let it was, him go.
It was great, because I would never have figured this out. I would have been still trying to figure out how to cut wire. So.
Well, you know, I wouldn't have helped.
No, it would have been terrible.
Damn bit. Because I came downstairs like eyes squinting, and I was like,
Lee was like, what are you two doing?
What are you two doing?
I was like, you're going to be upset.
I know. She came up and brought me coffee, and she was like, because she loves me. Yeah. And I said, what are y'all doing? Because I'd kick Stuart out because he was snoring so hard. So he was just on Christy's couch when she wakes up. I didn't even text her to tell her. He just existed.
I entirely expected it. It was fine.
Yeah, God, that man. But he was on the couch. And then I said, well, what are you guys doing? Are you... And she was like, you're going to be really disappointed.
And then she came down and she was like, oh, no, it's nerdy.
Yeah, I was like, oh, my. I thought it was going to be much sexier than what it was.
It was not. Okay, I'm going to take a drink of this.
Also, note, the Fat Pelican is my koozie.
Oh,
which is Christy and I's go-to in the summer.
I have a pal that has a TikTok where he just tastes drinks and then, like, reviews them. And
I'm ready.
I feel like I'm that right now. I'm going to take, okay, the blue raspberry. Oh my God, I'm so nervous. No. It gets worse. It gets worse the longer that you've had it.
You totally did like that kombucha girl meme, because at first, before it registered in your brain, you were like, maybe.
There was a second there where I was like, maybe it's fine. And then it like.
And then it was a firm no. And then it was a barf no.
And then it was like, started to get worse. So I chugged a normal one before, because I knew that this was going to go badly.
Oh no. Happy summer. Anyway. Yeah, so we're ending our summer of rejection with Christy. Mm-hmm. She's going to talk about something that was rejected.
Yes.
We have our summer drinks. I have my Fat Pelican koozie, which is in the greatest place of all time, Carolina Beach.
The great place.
Unequivocal.
Yep.
And then next week, we will start season 3. Because we always do it in the summer, yeah.
It's wild. It's wild that we made it this far. Shout out to everyone who still listens to us.
We're still friends.
We're still friends.
Christy and I drank wine and started debating liberation theology, except we kind of agree. So it was not really a debate.
The really nuanced debate.
Stuart thought we were fighting.
Stuart was just sitting there really quietly staring at us, because we were not sober, and many wines in debating this. And then Stuart was like, what is happening? And then Leah texted me. She was like, Stuart was worried that we were fighting.
I was like, I don't know what it would look like if Christy and I really got in it. You and I disagree about stuff. And we're both very stubborn. And like, we can definitely like get on each other. I can kind of tell when I'm getting on your nerves. Yeah. So, I mean, I think like it happens. It's, we hang out too much for it not to happen. But like, fight?
We don't.
Knock on wood.
I mean, I think, knock on wood.
We're too similar, I think, to fight. Because like, I think we're too, we have to do something out of character, I think. Like,
yeah. I also think healthy relationships, if I may say, involve a lot of communication. And we tend to communicate pretty well about.
And that's all we do.
Yeah. We don't have the other stuff, so.
Right. But also, I think, like.
Both entirely too straight for that.
There are moments, though, like, I think, where we are not ourselves because of your face.
It's so bad.
Because of various things. And so we'll do something out of character. And I think that's when, because you, I remember over the summer, you messaged me and you're like, are you okay? And it was because I did something quite out of character. And I think when we do that, then we're sort of like, are you okay? Because I think that's what would do it.
Yeah.
Like if Christy just decided to, like, I don't know, like, date someone real stupid and think he was awesome, I would be like, okay.
I do that a lot, but.
But she hasn't done it recently.
Wrong. Kind of stupid. I feel like most of the stupid I go for, you just be like, yep, that tracks. But
like. Well, not. Like, it doesn't sound like, no, like, someone's stupid.
Like, someone,
I don't
like.
Mean, like, someone doesn't like theology. I mean, like, someone is.
Like a KKK member, you'd be like, this
correct.
Is. Correct. Yeah.
Correct. Like, when I'm talking stupid, I mean, like, you can. Stuart and I have completely polar opposite interests, and he is very smart. I'm not saying that at all. But, like, we don't have a lot of overlap. But I mean, if you started dating, like, a right winger, I'd be like, Christy, what are we doing?
Yeah. No, there would be issues. We would be concerned at that
Unless
point.
He was really hot, and then I would get it. JK.
No, you know what? Because I dated a really hot guy once. We called him Hot Aaron. And there was a minute, and we were driving somewhere, and he was talking about something. And I remember staring at him and thinking, I thought you were hot. Why are you not hot anymore? And I texted one of my friends to be like, is he still hot? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, are you sure? And she was like, oh, you don't like him anymore, do you? I was like, oh, no. So the looks.
I think you're better at that than I looks, because I see a guy and I'm like, I mean.
Well, for a minute, but like in a relationship, all of a sudden you're like, you are not hot enough.
Oh, yeah. A relationship. Well, yeah. I'm not talking about that kind of relationship.
Yeah. Christine, like the relationship I have with this blue Raz. It's she a keeps, short-lived.
She keeps making faces like she's dying. And based on having had 2 out of the 4 flavors, I think it's probably accurate.
Yeah. It's, I'm going to rank them. So if any of you are interested in these truly unruly
lemon. They're deeply interested, Chris.
Firstly, don't do it, is my advice.
But if you're second, at a pool party and you're forced
to. At a pool party. The original one that's just straight lemonade, for sure the best.
Yep, I agree.
I think that the pineapple is second, and then the pink lemonade is third, and this blue
one. This one's dead last.
It's
quite, but you know, bad. I think finishing summer in September, this is a representation of that.
It's just what's left. Yeah.
It's what's left.
It's what's left.
It's what someone left at your house when when the beach time has ended, basically.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. It's like we did go to the beach. We went to the beach. These are the leftovers. This is the.
And I drank I bought a huge thing and I drank, I think, 2 of them. So Christy gets to live with my bad choice.
Stuart did a good job getting through the Coors Light, I will say. There's less of it left than I expected, which I appreciate.
Well, he drinks beer. Well, he's Scottish, first of all. But also Coors Light's like...
It's like water.
2%, I was going to say.
It's like, oh, look at my carbonated water.
But it's from the Rockies, Christy.
It's the worst of the Colorado beer.
Being a snob.
I have a real opinion.
What if Coors Light? So now we don't have Coors Light. We don't have Truly. The sponsorship is going down the tubes. It's going
down the tubes. Boda Box is our. That's Boda what we're Box. For here. We want
we're
Boda Box.
Still here for you.
Boda Box, we will sing all of your praises because we love you and we buy you all of the time. So.
Yes.
Okay. So to finish up our summer series. Is my final rejection. Not final rejection. I have many more. But the
I was going to say, that is super ambitious, Christine.
I have so many rejected things. There's just tons. But this is the final one I want to share with you.
Which okay, do we have any announcements before? Can I do announcements?
Oh, yeah. We have announcements, yes.
Sorry. But we are doing book group. We skipped September because we couldn't get our acts together, and that's on us.
Yeah, that's on us.
October, we're going to do Boy Erased, because we are going to, which is a band book, but it's also a book very related to what I'm doing my projects on, which I have showered, because I've been doing interviews for that, and I was like, I need to shower first. I need to restart.
I need a minute.
Which has just been, gosh, thank so you to weird. All the people, by the way, who, if you listen, who let me interview you, but also, whew. This book is going to be sad to write. So we're going to read that. And it's going to be, we're going to start doing it the 3rd week of the month. I think Christy and I decided, or she decided, I agreed silently.
Yeah.
And then the next month after that, so that'd be November, we're going to do Lord of the Flies.
Yes. So
which was a suggestion from Stuart.
From Stuart. We have 2 months planned out. So, yeah. So, it's going to be the 3rd week of November. Or, sorry, October and the 3rd week of November. Boy Erased and Lord of the Flies. So, you can all plan and join as you want. We had a really great time talking about All Boys Aren't Blue last month.
Yep.
And so, yeah. So, come join the book club. Also, Theology Beer Camp is coming up fairly soon. A month away.
Yeah. Which shocked me, honestly.
Yeah, I was not emotionally like in that state of mind yet, but now I am because it's too hot.
Because we have now officially retired summer as of today.
Yeah, summer is officially over. We're in the 5th week of school, so I'm real late on that. But
I know.
But yeah, we're excited about beer camp.
We're going to AAR in Boston. AAR, if anyone's around. Also, I do have a push for. And I'm going to put this up on the website. I am president-elect for AAR Southeast. And if you would like to take a winter vacation to the South, to the Greenville, South Carolina, you do not have to be in the South to be in this conference. But the call for papers is October 15th is actually the last day. So, and it happens over spring. I know. I'm going to send it to you.
Thank you for reminding me.
Yeah, it happens over spring break. And it's all the, it's not all the units, of course, of AR, but it's a lot of the same ones. So even if you don't do Christianity, it doesn't matter. Like, we have all kinds of different, like, methods of teaching. We have, you know, Islam, world religions, like, Bible, if you're a Bible person, like, you can.
I also, as a plug, I've not been to the Southeast, but I went to the regional conference for the Rocky Mountain region many times, and I presented a couple of times. And if you're newer to presenting, or if you just want a little bit more low key of a vibe, regional conferences are amazing. Like, it's not quite the stuffy feel of annual AR, national AR, and it's a lot more, you get a lot more feedback and collaboration, I think, at regional. So,
yeah, it's not quite the, like, blitz that the big one is.
Big AR.
And you get to hang out a lot more with people.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Good.
So that's our announcements for. I think that's it.
I think that's it.
Okay.
You were more prepared for the announcements than I was anyways.
Well, I knew that deadline for AR Southeast is coming up. And because I'm in charge of the papers, I'm hyper aware of it. My unit is Religion in the American South. So please do send me some paper. Because it's real. I mean, we've got everything from, like, I'm doing a joint panel on queer identity in the American South. Religious queer identity with Religion in America group, who are out of UNC Chapel Hill. And so it's everything from that to, like, I got papers on snake handling churches, like a qualitative research project on that. So it's, like, truly a very wide thing. So yeah, if you want to dip your toe, come dip your toe with us. Yeah.
I like that.
Too. I'm going to submit. Should I submit to my own unit? I'll probably submit to. I'll submit to the, I think, the queer identity one and just take myself out of the.
I was going to be like, is this like the Nepo baby of AR?
Yes. We don't examine our. Yeah. It's all blind examination. I can't confirm because I'm the one organizing it. And I would not submit my paper to my own unit. Although I'm sure people do. I'm sure that's like a thing.
I have heard many stories about that happening.
Okay.
Anyway. Our final, like I said, our final summer of rejection, not my final rejection, but our final one that we're.
Not anyone here's final rejection.
I have had so many. I will have many more to come. It's on a book that I had submitted this. For national AR in 2024. And I want to first state that I don't even remember which. I want to say it was the arts and literature section, but it might have been pop culture. But also, I remember throwing it together really last minute. And having prepped for today, I was like, okay, I have different ideas for this. So it's okay that it got rejected. I've accepted that. And I actually think it's probably a good thing that it got rejected. So this is not a sad rejection. However, we're going to talk about one of
sometimes you just get rejected because it's bad. Not bad, but it's not good.
Well, it just wasn't developed enough and I hadn't put, like, I didn't have time. It wasn't like I just didn't care, but I didn't put enough kind of like, I think, time into presenting the idea for the paper. And I also think that it probably just fits better in a journal article or something like that. And also probably with literature people a little bit more. But it's about a book that I read called Shark Heart. And it's by Emily Habeck. I get these books and I read them. It's through a club I'm not going to plug because I have issues with them, even though I pay the money. But you get a book a month. And you can probably assume what book or what thing it is, but you get a book.
You already plugged it once, unless it's a different group.
I don't know. Maybe I didn't. And I remember because they give you kind of like little blurbs to say, like, here's what the thing is. And I remember thinking, like, that sounds weird and kind of interesting. So I got it. and I had no idea what I was in for. And then it ended up being this book that it's so phenomenal. I love it so much that I have bullied most of my friends into reading it.
Except for me. So I'm not a real friend.
I don't know how you've escaped this. Because I definitely have, first time
hearing of it.
You need to read this book. It is the most beautiful book. It is genuinely, I think, one of my all-time favorite books. It's been something I've bullied a bunch of people into reading it. Most of them were like, I'm not going to read that. It sounds crazy. And then would text me and be like, this is the most wonderful book I've ever read. Thank you so much. And also, I kind of hate you still. And so, like, thank God it's not, but like,
Christy's ambitious with her books sometimes.
Sometimes I'm a little ambitious. I have a literature degree. It's what I do, but like, this is not that. I've had a couple of people who didn't like it, but most of the time I receive like similar views that I had. But Emily Habeck was a screenwriter initially, and so this is her first novel. She also went to Vanderbilt Divinity School.
What up, Jorg?
So if he knows her, he should shout her out for us. But she did. Yeah, she does play. She does screen at a writing playwright stuff. She doesn't do novels typically. And so it's really an interesting read because like in some parts, like Leah could see this, but like there's not a lot of text on that page. Right. It's pretty blank. But it actually, I think that the blank pages kind of contribute to the feel of the book. So there's a lot of important aspects in terms of the way that it's written, the style of writing. Again, the blank spaces play into the text as well, but it is also a kind of weird story. So what I don't want to spoil it for anyone. So I'm going to give you some information about the book, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about why I think it's helpful. So again, it's called Sharkheart, and it's called that because the main character is a character called Ren, and her husband has a disease. This is a kind of baseline aspect of this world, is that there are animal mutation diseases, and his turns him into a great white shark. There are other ones as well, and there are a few that are described in the text. So her mother had also had one. She turned into a Komodo dragon. She also meets a woman who is pregnant, and her babies in the womb have turned into birds. And so she has twin
babies. I didn't think pregnancy could get worse, but I think that makes
sense. Yeah, well, yes. So she's a tiny, they call her the tiny pregnant woman. She doesn't have a name. She's just tiny pregnant woman. And she's pregnant with birds, two birds. So it's this thing. And the text is using these mutations to talk about actual issues. For her mom, it's Alzheimer's. And so, you know, talking about her mom as she turns into a Komodo dragon, like starts to forget her, things like that. For the tiny pregnant woman with the birds, it's a discussion about abortion and reasons for abortions and stuff like that. So there's a lot of, I think it's pretty obvious what's going on with each of the mutations in terms of like, they're supposed to be symbolizing something else. But the book deals a lot with love and with grief and with hope. And it's just a really, really beautiful story. So again, I don't want to spoil it for anyone because I want everyone to read it. Please do. It's not a hard book to read because, like I said, there's a lot of blank pages. But I will stress, I think you should read the actual book and not. I know audiobooks are great and I listen to audiobooks sometimes, but I think this one maybe doesn't translate over to audio as well. But one of the things that I wanted to talk about with this book, and the reason I had started figuring this out, was that the book is dealing with really heavy issues. And I actually went to a book club meeting about the book, and everybody was kind of talking about the ways that the different issues presented by the different mutations had allowed them to kind of grapple with and wrestle with issues in their own lives. And again, it's common stuff. Some people talked about cancer. Some people talked about parents getting older, Obviously, there's a lot going on in terms of abortion and deciding whether or not to have abortions, how to understand pregnancy, how to wrap your mind around that. A lot of people talked about it in a kind of just general sense of like, if the world is on fire and we're all, you know, just generally struggling with things, how do we maintain any kind of sense of hope? And the book does a lot with that as well. And so there's a lot of things that the book does kind of hit you with, but the reasons that it's able to do that, I think, are what makes it so interesting. So it gets called, like, some people will talk about it as a magical realism or a fantasy book because it's about a man who turns into a great white shark. Sometimes it gets called a fabulous novel, but I actually think it fits better into absurdist literature. And absurdist literature is a whole genre of literature, mostly credited with Albert Camus. You're familiar with, because this was part of your COVID book.
Yep.
His novel, The Stranger, is usually one that people will reference in terms of absurdism. Kafka is also an absurdist writer. So Metamorphosis. So you want to think about it like it's very similar to the Metamorphosis. Like, he is changing into something, right? And Kafka's ability to use this change into a giant bug to talk about deeper issues is the same kind of thing that is going on with Sharkheart. Is like, how do we talk about these big issues and deal with the difficulties of life in ways that can actually get to us? And I think one of the other things that has stuck out to me a lot recently is this notion that we... This is something I've been kind of wrestling with for a few months now, actually. We want to be able to answer everything. We want there to be an explanation for everything. We want to have proof of stuff. You know, we are an enlightened society. The Enlightenment, we're very focused on science and scientific method and what is provable or what is verifiable. And there are so many instances, I don't know if you've kind of saw this or thought about this in your teaching of world religions, where there's so many instances where religions are actually trying to tell you, like, stop. Stop trying to rationalize these things. Stop trying to understand everything. I was teaching Zen Buddhism today, and the aspect of Zen Buddhism that includes these kind of puzzles that Zen masters will give their students, where they say things that are unsolvable. Does my dog have Buddha nature? And the master enters moo. Like, we're not going to answer the questions. We're not going to give you these easily understood ideas. We're not going to tell you what everything is. And there's a reason for doing that. And I think that absurdist philosophy and absurdist literature handles these big issues in such important ways. But as I was, like, researching it, one of the things that's a character...
Can I say something real quick just about that? Because I think the Enlightenment, as we've studied history, we know it was a lot of things, but it was also a reaction against the church kind of being in control of the truth narrative for basically a really long time. And it was a rejection of that and a real uplift of, as you said, the scientific method and means of garnering knowledge through the senses and things like that. And I get frustrated with it sometimes. I was on a podcast recently, which will be coming out. It's Homebrewed with Tripp, and it was Tom Ord and Josh Patterson about process stuff. And I'm like, you know, and I brought up the idea of mystery, and it's like, well, they're like, don't just throw around mystery. And I'm like, okay, well, do you want God to be measurable? Like, because we have people who do that. That was my response, is, you know, there are people who think that God has the absolute truth and there is no swaying from that, and they're called evangelicals, and I'm pretty sure y'all are not into that. So are we just moving the pendulum? Are we trying to make God into an Enlightenment being?
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a friend of the podcast who talks a lot about this idea that science is the only knowable thing. And I think that's the thing, is it's knowable within a system that we've created that is repeatable, and I get that. But, like, the idea that we could know God is in itself kind of an absurd claim, I think. And so I always find it interesting when people start using this science language for God, and then people are like, well, there's no way to know God, so I reject God. And I'm like, that is a fallacy. That's a logical fallacy in itself.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
I think one of my students actually yesterday was asking me, like, what kinds of opinions I have about provability of religion. And I said, like, I think that that's the wrong question entirely. If we're trying just to prove or disprove religious belief, then we're not really wrestling with what various beliefs or faiths are doing. Right. We're not wrestling with the ways that they've been helpful or harmful either.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really genuinely need to have proof of all of these things, and especially of God. The idea that we could prove that God exists or disprove that God exists is so insane to me that we have
that. That's absurdist to me.
Like, yeah, like that hubris is just, this is something outside of our realm of knowledge or our realm of the universe. Like, we can't reach that. Where is God?
Yeah.
You can't.
And, like, and believe in it or don't believe in it. And either way is fine, but also don't judge it according to things that it wasn't necessarily created to be judged against. I think, like, a system, like, what is the utility of this religion? Is it helping you? Okay. Well, then is it causing you to thrive?
Yeah.
Or good theology, then keep doing it. If it's bad, then, you know, leave it behind. If you can, hopefully you can, if you're not in a cult, and rage against the machine, in my opinion. Oh, God, Penny.
I mean, Penny is raging against the machine right at this moment. Penny, I am talking about important things. Hey, my neighbor is home.
Okay. She's like, where's Stuart and Leah?
There is a monster. I have to tell them about my existence. I think that, you know.
Like, if it's a vaccine, I'm cool. Like,
yeah,
science. Like,
I think that.
It's okay to not use science.
There was a class I took in seminary on 16th century Reformation theology, and one of the things
really thrilling.
I really loved that class. It was fun.
I'm sure.
Again, super nerd. But I remember one of the things my professor said was that we tend to judge other time periods as if we have reached the pinnacle of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
We assume that we are super smart and that we know everything that can be known, and that we are the ones who have figured out the ways to understand the world. And so we just make assumptions that people before us were not smart or that they didn't understand things. And one of the dangers with this is that it makes us assume that people didn't know that things were bad. Like, oh, well, we can't be mad at them for slavery because it was their time period or whatever. When in fact, there were just tons and tons of people who were abolitionists and knew that slavery was bad. Like, that knowledge was available, right? But also, it means that we think that important work that happened in the past is somehow not important because we're smarter than them just by the sheer fact that we live in this time period. And he mentioned too, we have no idea what kind of things will be discovered in the future that people will look back on us and think, like, oh, how could they possibly have thought these things, you know?
100%.
And so there needs to be an amount of humility in the ways we understand the world. And I think this is why using certain things to discuss really complex aspects of life, like death, or, again, very difficult situations like your parent getting dementia or Alzheimer, your partner getting cancer or whatever else, trying to make decisions about, again, the tiny pregnant lady was pregnant with birds, and birds birth by pecking their way through a shell. And so her pregnancy becomes super dangerous. And, like, this is part of that conversation is what is she supposed to do about the fact that she's pregnant with birds? And so how we have those conversations, we always kind of default to science and facts and stuff that we can prove. But absurdist literature lets us have these conversations in ways that actually allow for our minds to expand past stuff that we can prove or stuff that we can just like knee-jerk say, this is the right decision, this is the wrong decision. This is the right way to feel, this is the wrong way to feel. Or even, because his transformation into a great white shark takes most of the book. And so you get to see both Ren wrestling with her husband becoming a great white shark and him wrestling with becoming a great white shark. It goes back and forth. And the ways that this impacts people, the different approaches to it, all sorts of stuff. It's a really interesting look. But what I think is most interesting about this is that absurdist literature, so like Kafka and Sartre, Samuel Beckett, Albert Camus, all these people are really dealing with a kind of negative or pessimistic understanding of the world in terms of what we can know and what we can't know. And like Camus is in one of his, it's called, what is it called? It's his like the Myth of Sisyphus is his like philosophical essay. He says things like, there's an end to our knowledge. There's only so much we can know. And this makes the world absurd. We can't know why certain things happen. And we have to just kind of let it go. And he says that there are aspects of science that we can't really comprehend, but that there are also aspects of life that we can't comprehend. This is, again, why he calls it absurd. And he says here, this is my favorite quote from that essay. He says, at last, man will again find there the wine of the absurd and the bread of indifference on which he feeds his greatness. And it's like, we are trying to make ourselves capable of dealing with all of these things instead of recognizing that these things are just complicated and difficult and kind of absurd. Absolutely. It's absurd that these things happen to us. It's absurd that we have Alzheimer's. It's absurd that we have cancer. Like, it just is. But also, it's true that we have those things and we have to deal with them. And so what are we going to do? And I think that most of these writers are really pessimistic about it. Like, if this is all terrible and absurd and like, blah, and that's the end. And Sharkart takes all of this absurdity and then it gives us a way to move forward. And I'm not going to spoil it, like the end of the book, but the end of the book gives us this notion of hope that even in the face of these things, we can still find love and we can still find faith and we can still find ways to move forward. And I think that it takes typical absurdist literature and twists it just enough to say, actually, the absurd things can be good too. Like, we can look back and say that, you know, I loved this person and I lost this person and it's terrible, but it's also still good. And I still get to like continue on. I still get to love in other ways, or I still get to live in other ways, or whatever. The tiny bird lady gets to decide whether or not she's going to have the birds, you know, but that's something for her to decide rather than for us to just say, like, scientifically, you should definitely do X or Y, right? Like, and again, it really does kind of bring it into a conversation where, like, you can see a new way to approach that whole conversation, like the whole abortion, so that you're, I mean, it's very pro-choice, but like, to understand the ways to talk about it that are not just screaming at each other, different ways to approach grief. There's a lot of dealing. I mean, I like cried through the last half of the book. But it's so beautifully done in the way that it just lets you feel things without having to have rational explanations and allowing us to recognize the bigger things than our intelligence or our ability to know those things. And so I don't actually remember what I was proposing to do in this paper, because it was like, I want to talk about this book with absurdist literature and like the notion of the absurd. And then I probably just sent that off and they were like, but what are you going to do?
I mean, I think that's, but I think it's interesting, at least what I'm reading into it whenever you're talking, is that you do have a perspective, which is this idea that, and I want to emphasize, I mean, I wrote a book called Bad Theology. Like, I believe that there are things that we can say are objectively something, like genocide is objectively bad.
Objectively terrible.
But I do think what you're saying is that, and kind of what we led with is, you know, we can't take every system of discernment or even discernment of truth or even coping mechanism and apply it across the board. Like, I think that's the thing is that, you know, you can't take the scientific method that maybe was helping your mother with her Alzheimer's. I'm saying this as, you know, whatever, not that she does, but anyone, you can't take that same method and say, all right, we're going to apply those same Alzheimer's scientific methods to your grief as she goes through that. Like, those things are not the same. Because you'd look and be like, well, I mean, sure, if you want to give me a Xanax and knock me out or something, then okay. But I'm going to wake up and she's still going to not remember who I am. That grief exists, right? So I just, or you can do counseling or whatever, but the grief's still, and I think that's it. To me, that's really powerful, is saying, like, we don't have to pigeonhole. We don't want to go back to pre-enlightenment where we just are bleeding people out because they have demons inside of them. But it is saying that not all methods fit every scenario. And sometimes we need to open that up a little bit. And I think that's important.
Yeah. And I think it's important for us to recognize that sometimes the idea of a rational approach to an emotional situation is not helpful. You know, like, when we are faced with the fact that our husband is turning into a great white shark, there might be an irrational response to it. And simultaneously, that's a kind of correct response, because And the reason I think that she uses these animal mutations is to point out that, again, it feels really absurd when your person that you love is suffering a fatal you know, it feels absurd. It feels incorrect. We have a, like, I don't know what it feels like to not exist. You know, I've always existed in my consciousness. I can't imagine a state in which I don't exist. That feels absurd. And yet, simultaneously, I have not existed and I will not exist again. You know, like, those things are true, but I can't rationally wrap my head around what that would mean. You know, like, I don't know how people are going to grieve. I don't know, like, maybe I'm the last one to die. Like, I don't know, you know, like, there's an amount of absurdity that comes along with these kinds of losses that we have to be better at allowing for. It reminds me a lot. I read C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed when my brother-in-law died. And I remember he said that grieving his wife made her both more present and less real, because he was grieving a memory of her that didn't include the things that annoyed him or the things that were frustrating. He was grieving this kind of perfected version. And in that, he had taken away the reality of her. And then he started to grieve that. He was like, I'm grieving the fact that I don't remember her correctly, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's how it felt. Like, I remember my brother-in-law in ways that aren't necessarily accurate to his character, you know? Because I have assigned a kind of affection to him in my state of missing him. So, like, understanding the ways that, again, science can't answer these questions. We need to. And that something else is art. Like, art is the thing that can help us struggle through all of this stuff. And especially now, our art is the thing that would help us to answer some of these questions. And we need to maybe, I think, unclench our fists around the kind of science priority and let some things be unexplained.
Yeah. I mean, when I was doing chaplaincy, that was a big thing too, is like, you know, they taught us how to do, you know, talk, and they taught us theology, and they were like, here's what you, and most of the time when people were in the midst of grieving, they didn't want the logical stuff. They wanted to be able to cry and scream and rage a little and you know, the doctors would come in. I always joke, but like I would always get paged when the doctors, when things got emotional, the doctors would say, you need to come in because they're upset. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, we don't touch that.
Yeah.
You know, we're here to heal and that. And when they start getting emotional. Great. Yeah. And that's when we love that.
Thanks the doctors. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, my mom's a nurse. She's got stories to tell.
Mm-hmm.
She is a miracle worker in that sense. But it doesn't. But then I would come in when stuff got emotional and, you know, it would be like me reciting, you know, let's say there was a kid with cancer, me reciting all of the numbers that the doctor had given them about, you know, cell counts and all of this stuff. They would be like, mm-hmm. wait, you're the chaplain. Why are you saying that? Like,
yeah. It would be weird.
It'd be weird, you know? And so I think in that sense, we do this on the day to day. Like, it's just mm-hmm. that for some reason, when rubber hits road, it's science or it's nothing. And it's like, well, that's not how life works. You know, we wouldn't still have, you know, even religion or counseling or, you know, fill in the blank friendships. Like if this method of solving some problems was able to solve all of them, we wouldn't need those other systems. But we have created a series of systems to help us live this thing we called life.
And yeah. Yeah.
Not all
to allow us to have these moments that are unexplainable too, I think.
Yes.
There's a poem, the author's name has escaped me, but she was going to visit her son. She was Russian. She was going to visit her son.
I was going to say Leah Robinson until you said son, and then I was like, no, never mind. And then you went Russian, and I was like.
She's standing in line with the other family members to go visit their families who are their members who are in this prison. And it's like, the story is like, it's cold and the wind is blowing and they've been waiting in this line for hours. And one of the women turns around to her and says, can you describe this? And she says, I can. But then she writes a poem. She doesn't explain, here's the temperature. This is what it was like. This is, you know, she's giving you the sense and the emotional connection to that feeling. And that makes you understand it. And like with Sharkheart, looking at these animal mutations helps you to understand this is what it's like to lose your mother to Alzheimer's. Mm. This is how it feels. This isn't the step-by-step process because that's always different. This isn't like a scientific explanation of Alzheimer's, you know, but these are the feelings that you get. These are the emotions. But like I said, then at the end of the book, rather than just leaving it in this kind of absurd place that you get with a lot of those texts, she starts to explain how absurd it is to have hope and that also is important. And like having hope and continuing to live within the hope is what's sustaining, you know, it's what the kind of point is. And I think that it's a really incredible way of dealing with. Like, I can't tell you why I have hope because it's irrational to have hope. It's absurd to have hope. But also, I think it's important to have hope. And that's what she shows you at the end. And so it's just like, it's just a great way of looking at a kind of the absurdity of life doesn't have to be pessimistic, which we get most of the time with the absurd writers. And so I love it.
Kafka's not really drinking.
Yeah, Kafka's not. He's not on, like, it's all going to be fine now, guys. Like, you're a giant bug. Like,
literally wrote a book called The Plague.
Yeah. Camus is like, everything is but. Yep. You know, like, it's just so much. And, like, they're great. I love them. You know, like, I love reading absurdist literature. It's interesting. And it connects us to the, like, funk of humanity. You can tell I've also, because I've like deep into my humanities class and we keep watching Cornel West videos and he always talks about the funk. It's like, this is the funky part. Like, this is it's the stench, it's the dirt, it's the messiness. But like, that's the part that's real, you know? That's the part that matters. And it's not that I can explain that the sun is going to come up, or I can explain that, like, you know, we all die and then we turn into worm food or what have you. But like that I can deal with the emotional absurd aspects. And I think that's beautiful. So you should read it. This is me bullying you into reading Shark Heart. I should have.
Well, I'm not a real friend because you haven't told me yet.
So. I don't know how that's possible because I went on a real bender about it. It's going to start up again. Everyone I know is going to be sick and tired of hearing about it.
Is Shark Heart a banned book? We could put it in the book group.
Sure is not. It's not a banned book. But it's a lovely book. Look how beautiful. Look, it's a flower shark on the cover.
Your aesthetic to a T.
It's beautiful. I know, right? So I highly recommend it. It's a great book. But also, what I want to do now instead is to write a journal article and submit it, because I feel like I've done enough presentations about grief and I don't want to do that again.
Are you sad, Christy? Are you sad?
Hard. Like, I don't want to cry.
Northern Ireland, bad theology, the freaking COVID plague.
Look, I will write about it, Leah. I will write about it. But like, do you know what it's like when you're standing up at AAR and you have to be like,
yes, I do.
So my brother-in-law died. Let me tell you about it.
Yeah.
It sucks. Yeah.
It's sad. I'm going
to try to like make this one something I don't have to read aloud in front of people.
That's fair. That's fair.
But I think it's such a great book and I'm glad that you have to read it. I'm going to send it to you.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if our friendship can uphold.
It will.
Fine.
Well, it's the real test, because if you hate it, we're done.
Jeez. Didn't know I was on such a tightrope over here. I'm like, Christy, I don't measure friendship by books.
By books,
I do. It actually comes full circle, because we talked about being stupid.
I did. One time I gave somebody a book, and I wrote in the front cover, I said, you better fucking like this.
When given that, like,
yeah.
Well, I think that actually leads well into next week, which when we're going to talk about grief.
Yep, we're going to talk about.
We're going to do a summer review.
Yeah.
From a theological perspective, and also just looking at, you know, my little guy here on my desk that says this is fine, where everything is on fire,
mm-hmm.
feels very appropriate right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I made a cross stitch last spring that I hung up in my room that says, this too shall pass, but what the fuck?
Yes. Yep. But every morning I wake up and I'm just, or afternoon, let's screw. And I'm like, oh God.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk.
We're going to talk about all of that. Yeah. It's going to be grand.
So hopefully your summer of rejection or is not as rejected as we were, but it is important to note that academics get rejected on the regular. Even Christy laughed when she said this is her last rejection.
It's not.
It's not. And I laugh because I also, it's not for me either. But do know that, you know, it's a part of it. And it's kind of what you have to do. It's a part of the whole game is you, it can be the most beautiful, wonderful, logical, sponsored by the government. You know, it's a book or a movie, you know, like the back of your hand,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't always matter. Like that's not always the case that everyone else is going to be on board.
And like we talked about last week too, like sometimes you know why it got rejected. I know why this got rejected. I mean, not like specific, but I like have a feeling, you know?
Yeah. And sometimes you won't. And that's okay.
Sometimes you don't. But sometimes you're like, yeah, that tracks. But don't stop submitting. And don't stop loving those projects that got rejected, because there's a place for many of them in a different spot.
There is.
You can find it elsewhere.
Yeah. I will be doing my 50th anniversary Rocky Horror at Beer Camp.
I will be there.
You will.
I will.
Yeah, you will be there. I've already co-opted you.
I mean, look. You and I both. I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast, but I still remember my first Rocky Horror.
We did. You talked about it when we did the paper. Yeah.
I was like, I know I told you. I just remember if it was public, but it was great. It was great.
So come, if you want to see us recreate a memory, come to your old beer camp.
That, and also our hot ones. Because we always
doing the hot ones.
Doing the hot ones.
I am going to be terrible. Doing.
I hate it so much.
And yet, year three, she's still here.
I'm still here. This is how you know it's true love.
Right. I may have to do non-veggie chicken nuggets this year because I'm blaming it on the chicken nuggets, but really we're just eating molten lava, so I don't know why it's the chicken nugget problem.
I don't know how the nuggets are the problem here. I don't know how you're going to have anything other than the nuggets, but...
Or maybe I don't need to drink beforehand, which is not going to happen, so that's...
You know, like our dear Tom, who had heartburn for 24 hours because of the...
I mean, poor Tom. Sorry, Tom, but also...
Sorry, Tom. You're a rock star. Sorry.
That's part of the game as well, so...
What happens when you make friends with us?
I was going to say, you get on that one's challenge. But also, I'm going to be doing a panel with Adam Clark. On liberation theology.
I'm looking forward to that a lot. It's going to be great.
Yep. So come on and join us. And goodbye, summer.
Cheers.
It went by too fast.
It went too fast as usual. Cheers to the end of summer. As usual.
Cheers.
This is the most disgusting drink I've ever had in my life.
Mine does taste like a rocket pop.
I said that and then immediately remembered the redneck martini. So I take it back. That was worse.
I was going to say, we've come far. And if you've not listened to that first episode.
The second one. It's our second episode. Go back and just witness the horrors. That was a bad one. Thanks, Trip.
Thanks, Trip. All right.
All right. See you next week. Bye.